Today is September 4th, 2020. This is a Grand Canyon Oral History interview with Curt Sauer, C-U-R-T-S-A-U-E-R. My name is Tom Martin. Good morning, Curt. How are you?
Good morning, Tom. I'm doing pretty well.
Good. Thank you so much for your willingness to participate in this oral history program. What year were you born?
1950.
And where were you born?
Fairbanks, Alaska.
What were your folks doing in Fairbanks?
My father was in the Air Force.
Okay.
And I just happened to be stationed at Fairbanks when it was time for me to be born.
Okay. And how'd your dad meet your mom?
I don't know.
Okay.
He was assigned to Coastal Patrol in World War II on the Oregon coast.
Wow.
Mom was from Roseburg, Oregon.
Oh, neat.
And not exactly sure how they met.
Okay.
But I'm assuming it was someplace in close to Roseburg, Oregon.
Fun. What year did they get married? Do you remember?
Those kinds of details you'd have to talk to my sister-in-law, who's a family historian.
Okay. Did you have any older brothers and sisters, or were you the first child?
No, I was the fourth and last child.
Okay.
So my brother Rick Sauer, was Richard L. Sauer, named after my dad, is 5 years older than me, so he was born in 45. And my oldest sister, Sandra, I believe was born in 44. She died when she was 8 years old.
Oh.
I don't really remember much of her, except for the pictures.
Mm.
And then my third sibling, my younger sister, is Diane. And she was born in 46.
Okay. Nice. Fairbanks. Did you guys stay in Fairbanks, or did your father travel with the Air Force much more?
We moved every 2 to 3 years.
Okay.
His career. So we left Alaska about a year after I was born. Went back to Buckley Air Force Base in Aurora, Colorado. Moved around. I was in Newfoundland for first, second, and third grade. I was in Massachusetts for fourth, fifth, and sixth grade, South Adelaide Falls. I was in Madrid, Spain, for 7th and 8th grade.
Hang on a second. Wait a minute. What do you remember about Newfoundland?
Yeah. Well, 1st, 2nd, and 3rd grade, so 6, 7, and 8, right? Here's what I remember about Newfoundland. In the winters, we ice skated, we played hockey.
Wow.
In the summers, we went fishing. So, yeah, in the winters at Newfoundland, there was a large lake close to where we lived. The ice was about 2 to 3 feet thick, as I recall.
Wow.
And the club, probably an officer's club, would get together in the winter, and fathers would get a hold of some sort of a tractor that had a plow on the front of it, and they would plow the snow off of the ice, and it was 10, 12-foot wide pathways. And if you skated the whole thing, you skated a couple of miles, but it was full of loops, and you got tired of skating, you went back to the warming hut and had some hot chocolate.
and something to eat. So we'd spend hours out there.
Wow.
And then,
did you get good at hockey? Did you like hockey?
I wouldn't say I got good by today's standards. But, we were a bunch of rank amateurs. Backyard. We lived in a housing complex, and there was a big, huge field behind where we lived. So that would get, part of it would get flooded with water about 2-3 inches thick, and that was our at-home hockey rink.
Nice.
So, yeah, so we just played hockey. We didn't have any helmets. We didn't have any face masks. We didn't have any hockey gloves, that's for sure.
Lots of bruised hands and shins I can see there.
Yeah.
And did you learn to swim there in the summer?
Well, you learn to get in the water and get out real quick.
Okay, never mind.
Yeah, there wasn't much swimming because the lakes were just too cold.
Huh.
So I don't really remember where I learned to swim.
Okay.
Must have been in Aurora, who knows. So we moved, after Spain, we moved back to Aurora, Colorado. My dad is from Boulder. He retired in Aurora. That would have been in 1963, 64.
So take me to Spain for a little bit. What was Madrid like?
Madrid was fun. We lived in, I would say it was a well-to-do part of Madrid, and that's just based on the fact that all of the houses had walls built around them, and the neighbor three doors down had a backyard swimming pool. So I assumed at the time that they must have had some money. And so it was an interesting time. The 7th grade, 1363, yeah. So, my passion was baseball.
Okay.
And, I drew a target on the stucco wall out in the street and went across to the other side of the street and used the curb as a pitching mound. And when my dad came home, he wasn't too happy. But it stayed up. And so we would be bused onto Torjon Air Force Base to go to school. And then we'd be bused back. So during school year.
What was the name of the Air Force Base?
Torjon, Torrejon, I think.
Thank you.
Yeah. So I played baseball. And I was good at math, and that's about all I remember about school. We did take an all-star baseball trip in 8th grade, I guess it was. And we went to Paris to play against the American teams that had an all-star team there.
Wow.
So I got to see the Eiffel Tower, and I mean literally see it. We didn't get out of the bus.
Oh.
And after the game, we headed out, and I guess we went through Belgium and played there. And then we went to Wiesbaden, Germany, and played several games there, and then we came home.
That must have been a long bus ride.
That was nice. They're all kind of close together in the countries over there.
Couple days, maybe?
Yeah, it was probably about 4 days, 5 days.
Okay.
Staying in quarters on bases. There's two vivid memories I have of being in Spain. Three, actually. One was I was in Spain when President Kennedy was assassinated.
Hmm.
And we got off the bus from school, as I recall. And had to walk about a half mile to the house. And I just remember all of the Spanish people. When you walk by, they all got quiet. And they just looked at you like, we're really sorry.
Wow.
Because they kind of liked President Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
So that was one. The other one, I frequently would go to bullfights by myself.
Wow.
And my dad took the family to bullfights. And it wasn't that hard to get there by the trolley. And the trolley, as I recall at the time, cost one peseta, which is about one penny.
Wow.
And I was good enough to speak in Spanish that I, you know, I'm not fluent in Spanish by any means, certainly not now. But I was able to talk enough to figure out which trolley to get on as a 14-year-old in Spain. And went to the bullfights, which at the time I thought were quite majestic, very ornate, very colorful, and thick doors, just as brave as the matadors. So it was generally a different culture. On trash day, out in front of the house, put your trash cans out, and the garbage man would come by in his mule or burro pulled wagon, and he would dump all your trash in his wagon, and then they'd transport it not too far, and then went down to the dump a couple of different times, and it was just an open field with mounds and mounds and mounds of trash.
Wow.
Lots of birds.
Yep.
And lots of very poor people picking through the trash, looking through stuff for stuff that they could use.
Yeah.
So we lived in a what I would call an affluent neighborhood, and we weren't very far away from the very poor and the gypsies,
mm-hmm.
who were all very nice. Very nice. So sort of a simple life. 13-14 year old.
I think that'd be an incredible education.
I learned to swim in Spain, now that I think about it.
Oh, okay.
Because I would go down to this friend's house that had a pool, and I remember coughing and gagging, and I remember him telling me, when you come up, blow out through your nose, and that won't happen.
Hmm.
So from there, during the summers, I routinely went up to the area pool, which is a bike ride that took about 5-10 minutes, and swam up there, and I remember jumping off of high diving boards, not diving, but jumping off of high diving boards. So I guess I learned to swim in Spain, now that I think about it.
Nice. Did you guys take vacations at that time? Did you travel Europe at all while you were there?
My dad and my mom and my sister and my brother, mostly my mom, dad, sister, Diane, traveled quite a bit. Well, traveled. They'd go down to Barcelona for the weekend, the beach, some other towns. I stayed home because they traveled in the summer and it was time to play baseball.
Okay.
So I missed out on seeing a lot of the art. There was one museum in Madrid, I'm trying to remember the name of it. Starts with a P. So I did see some art, but as far as getting out in the country to go to other towns or go to the ocean, Mediterranean, I didn't go. I spent a lot of time in the winters in the Pyrenees skiing. My dad was a avid downhill skier.
Wow.
We'd get on a bus and go up and stay a night or two in the Pyrenees and ski for 2 or 3 days. And then come home. So other than the Pyrenees and the museum and the bullfights, I don't really recall. Oh, and I learned to, my dad was a member of the Rotten Gun Club, and that was when I got my first 16-gauge shotgun, and learned to shoot, trap, and skeet. And then occasionally we would go dove hunting, and dove hunting involved a bunch of different guys in different cars. Yeah, there's some memories going back. So you were responsible for getting to a certain village on your own. So we'd leave late after you got off work and drive almost all the way there and stop and camp and get up the next morning early and get to the village. And this Rod and Gun Club would hire the local villagers to start about 2 miles away from you in a long band of men and boys. And their job was to flush all the quail and the doves out of the brush so that they would fly towards you. And then as they came over, you would shoot at these birds. And I remember doves being one of the hardest things to hit with a shotgun because of their flight patterns.
Mm.
In fact, it probably took me three different hunting trips before I actually got a dove. But I got really good with the shotgun, which helped me out later when I became a ranger. I was very familiar with shotguns, and most of the rangers weren't. So on the range, when we had to qualify, it was never a problem.
Nice.
So, that's my recollection of Spain as far as traveling. I really didn't see too much as a tourist.
That's nice.
Look at the bullfights.
Huh, interesting. And then back to Aurora. And did you finish high school there then in Colorado?
Yeah, I graduated from William C. Hinckley High School in Aurora in 1968.
Okay. Had your bigger brother and bigger sister gone on to college? Was that something expected of you?
I was the first one in my family to go to college.
Okay.
My sister was, I think she was a senior. No, she must have been a junior. When we left Spain, my brother had graduated from high school. And he decided that he would join the Army when we got home.
Okay.
My sister stayed in Spain for another year of what they called finishing school. But she didn't go to an American high school for her senior year. She went to a finishing school someplace in Spain. Might even have been France. I don't know. For a year. And then she came home, lived at home for a while. My brother was in the Army. He was in the infantry. And he had a very distinguished career, actually.
Did your dad have a problem with him going in the Army, your dad being in the Air Force, or?
No.
Okay.
He didn't have a problem going in the Army as long as he was successful.
Okay.
So, Dad retired as a lieutenant colonel, and he thought the military was an honorable profession.
Mm-hmm.
And, he never expressed any regret that my brother went in the in the Army.
Nice.
So Rick went in the Army, came out of boot camp as a second lieutenant, somehow or another. Ended up going to Nam, his first tour. Was wounded in a hellacious battle. And at the time, my dad was flying to United Airlines. After he retired, he had over 10,000 hours of time in transport aircraft in the military.
Wow.
So he went to work for United. United stuck the whole, my mom and dad and I, on a plane, first class, flew us to Tripoli, Hawaii, flew us to Tripoli Hospital, I believe it's in, I don't know what town it's in, Oahu, wherever, put us up, and we were able to go over and see my brother recover, and he recovered over there for probably 2 weeks, and then we shipped back to Laura Fitzsimmons Army Hospital, and spent, I don't know, 6 months recovering from his wounds. And he told the Army that he would re-enlist if they would train him to be a helicopter pilot. Because he wanted to go back and protect the infantry on the ground.
Nice.
And he went back and got shot down 7 times and rescued 7 times.
Wow.
Came home after that and continued on for a 20-year career, and then he had about 20 years of flying for Continental Airlines, I guess, before he was forced to retire at 65.
Did you ever fly with your father on military transport planes when he was flying?
Is the question, did I ever fly?
Yeah. Did you ever get a chance to fly with your dad on as he was doing his transport work?
No.
Okay.
No, chance to fly with him on military transport. However, he was a pilot. So when we were still in Massachusetts, so that would have been no later than sixth grade. No, wait a minute. Yeah, no later than sixth grade. Probably fifth grade, so that's 11 when I was 11, sometime in there. He rented a Beaver airplane on wheels, and we put mom and dad, 3 kids, and family dog in this Beaver and flew from South Hadley Falls, Massachusetts, cross country and up into the Yukon, where we met up with another buddy who was also a pilot. So, I don't know, it took us days to travel there. And I guess he got the bug when he was up there. So when he retired from the Air Force in the summers, when I was a sophomore, junior, and senior in high school, we would leave late June from Aurora and fly up to Teslin, which is just outside of Whitehorse in the Yukon.
How do you spell that?
T-E-S-L-I-N.
Thank you. Outside of Whitehorse, okay.
And he and his buddy had what they called the hunting and fishing camp.
Okay.
Flying. So we would fly people around, and there weren't that many customers. So he ended up getting contracts with various companies to fly into mines that were out in the wilderness and had dirt strips. So we would fly into the mining camp and pick up the ore samples to take them back to be assayed at Placer Mine. Or he would fly around in his plane with a location beacon looking for weather balloons for the government, I believe it was the U.S. government, but it might have been the Canadian government, after the weather balloons came back down, they had to be located in the brush.
Oh, interesting.
Bush. And so he'd locate them, then they would get a helicopter and land at the closest accessible place. So I was up flying into lakes and onto dirt strips as a fifth and sixth grader. Sophomore, junior, senior year in high school.
Let's back up a minute. Now, you mentioned the Beaver. Was that one of these giant kind of amphibian twin engine things?
No, it's a single engine.
Okay. Yeah, and then all right, to get then from in the summers, you mentioned your dad would leave in late June and head up to the Yukon. Would he rent a plane, or did he have his own plane?
Well, they had this company, and in Canada at the time, might still be that way. You couldn't, if you weren't Canadian, you couldn't own a majority interest in the company.
Okay.
So there was a third partner who I never met who owned the planes.
Okay.
And, I could go on and on about Dad and his experiences up there, but...
just a little bit. So would he keep the planes then down in Colorado in the winter and then fly them back up for the season in the summer?
No, we flew up commercially.
Okay.
To Whitehorse.
All right.
And the planes were overwintered there.
Were you interested in flying? Did you fly?
Well, that was one of my memories I was going to mention. We were flying quite a bit, and he said, "So you want to learn to fly?" I said, "Not really. I'd rather be on the ground hiking."
Huh?
And he said, "Okay, well, I'll teach you to fly in the air." So I would fly, and when we were going cross country on the flights, I would fly the plane. And of course, he was sitting in the pilot seat. I was sitting in the co-pilot seat, and he never went to sleep while I was flying, I can guarantee you that.
Mm-hmm.
So, but when it came time to land, and he never taught me to land. He would have taught me how to fly, but I chose not to, which I think mystified him, because he loved to fly.
Did he teach your elder brother, did he teach Rick how to fly?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. What about your sister?
No.
Okay.
I don't know how many times she would actually get in the plane voluntarily.
Okay.
So we'd spend a short 2 month period of time, July and August. And again, the Canadian people are some of the nicest people I've ever met.
Mm.
Dad had to be out of town one time for my 16th birthday, I guess it was, maybe 17th, probably 16th birthday. So it was 10 o'clock, time for coffee, and I walked up from the camp into the town, which was about a mile away, and sat down in the cafe, and out came a birthday cake.
Wow.
So they said, "Your dad ordered this. Happy birthday." So I lugged the whole cake, last one piece, back to camp, which was pretty nice. It was on a lake. It was a log cabin, but a nice log cabin that we rented from somebody that had it, I imagine, as a summer home. Dad became good friends with the locals, most of whom were natives, First Nations people. And Maggie, older lady, kind of adopted Dad. He went out of his way to make sure that she and her two sons, must have been grandchildren, actually, now I think about it, had enough to eat and enough to buy some clothes, and in exchange, she sort of adopted him. I still have the gun case that she made for him out of moose hide.
Wow.
Embroidered, beaded, as a gift to him for what he did. And friends with an Indian guide. So he was well respected. There was another time that he was out of town and had nothing to do, and apparently I fell in with the wrong group of people. I'm walking home, quote, late at night. In the summer, late at night is 10:30. And a Royal Canadian Mounted Police officer drove by and stopped and said, "Hop in, I'll give you a ride." I think I said, "No, that's okay, I'll walk." He said, "Hop in, I'll give you a ride." So as he was giving me a ride back to town, he said, "You're not hanging out with the people that your father would want you to be hanging out with.
Huh?
I want you to stop hanging out with them." "Yes, sir, I will." And sure enough, when my dad got back, within the day, he sat me down and said, "I understand the constable so-and-so gave you a ride home." "Yes, sir, he did." "Okay, do I need to say anything else?" "No, sir." So I was well looked after even when Dad wasn't around and everybody knew who I was. That was Dick's dad, Dick's son. So we fished a lot. And pulled into little inlets in the lake. Nobody looked like nobody had ever been in them.
Hmm. What kind of boat did you guys have?
Oh, it was a little 16-foot outboard.
Okay.
And speaking of swimming, that's a vivid recommendation. When you wanted a bath and jumped in the lake, got wet, climbed out, soaked up, jumped back in the lake, climbed out as quick as you could. And waited about half an hour for the headache to go away.
Well, you had good training in that from Newfoundland, so.
Yeah. Learned to drive a bulldozer. There, I think it was a small little Caterpillar bulldozer. And let's see, what else can I recall here? Now, for my 18th birthday, we were over in Saskatchewan someplace, flying ore samples and staying in a two-story apartment building. And I got home and was doing something, and Dad came in and said, "Well, happy birthday, son, you're 18. Great, let's celebrate my birthday." And he said, "Okay." And his partner walked in with a case of beer and a bottle of bourbon. The next morning, I woke up draped over a log in the forest. I made my way back to the apartment house. All the doors were locked, so I climbed up the downspout to get to the second, the roof on the first floor, so I could reach the windows to get into where we lived.
Yep.
And as I pushed open the window, there were two rifles pointed at me. And Dad said, "Don't ever try to come through the window." Those were some different days.
Yeah. Were you thinking about college then? Were there some things about further education that we're attracting you?
Well, I guess I would say it wasn't any pressure, but I would say that it was expected that I would go to college.
Okay.
Of course, like so many other young boys, my dream was to be a professional baseball player.
Okay.
And come junior year, when I still hadn't made varsity, I finally figured out I wasn't good enough.
Huh.
So in my senior year, I quit playing ball and got a job so that I could make some money to pay for college. And
what did you do?
Well, let's see. My first job was working at Burger King.
Okay.
And that lasted for a while. And then a couple of buddies that also worked there decided we needed a raise, 10 cents an hour. So two of them went to the manager and said, we want raises, 10 cents an hour. And he said, you're not getting a raise. He said, okay. We quit. He said, okay, see ya. So I came into work and said, so you want a raise too? I said, no, I'm going to keep working here. It would be nice if I could get a nickel an hour more. He said, no, if you keep working here, you can work here for a nickel more an hour. While in the kennel boy at Dr. Sunshine for 2 years. And then I drove a pizza delivery truck, made arrangements with the manager there that I would work on Friday nights because my girlfriend was a pom-pom girl and she was always busy on Friday nights with football games or basketball games.
Hmm.
And Saturdays, you usually weren't any games, so she had Saturdays off, so I had Saturdays off, so I was never too interested in football anyway. Never played football until ninth grade. Came back from Spain, American football.
Mm-hmm.
Back from Spain and decided I'd go to go play football. I knew absolutely nothing about football. I knew absolutely nothing about basketball. And in ninth grade, I made junior varsity.
Wow.
So, then it was 10th grade, it's time to change schools, go to high school. And I just decided, since I didn't know anybody, that I wasn't going to go out for football. So I never played football, and certainly never played basketball.
Okay. But it sounds like you were good at putting objects on targets.
Putting objects on what?
Targets.
yeah. Yeah, so that was, I don't know, that's Spain. That was summers during high school up in the Yukon. I think from there, I decided that I wanted to be a forest ranger just because of experiences. And so I went to college, started at Northeastern Junior College in Sterling, Colorado in the fall of 1968. And that was a farming town. Lived in a dorm for a quarter. Met a fellow by the name of Larry Van Fleck in a surveying class.
How do you spell Larry's last name?
Capital V-A-N, capital S-L-Y-K-E.
Thank you.
I haven't talked to him yet to see if he'd be willing to talk with you, but if you're going to do some oral histories on people that worked in Grand Canyon, I highly recommend you interview Larry.
Okay.
And I'll get permission from him to
Thank you.
Give you his contact information.
That'd be great. Thank you.
Larry was a seasonal ranger at the time at Rocky Mountain National Park.
Huh. So was he teaching the class?
No, he was a student.
Okay.
And he hadn't gotten a college degree. I guess he's about 4 years older than me, something like that. So he decided that he'd, at the time, park rangers, there's the 025 series for park ranger and the GS 026 for park technician. And he was a park technician. And at the time, you couldn't be a park ranger unless you had a college degree.
Oh, okay.
So he decided he'd go back to college, or he'd go to college. And walked in, sat down, just happened to sit down next to Larry in the surveying class. We struck up a conversation, and he became best friend and mentor. And at that time, I was still thinking about being a forest ranger, United States Forest Service. And he said, well, you know, why don't you be a park ranger? So that summer, I rode my bike from Aurora up to Estes Park.
Wait, stop. Aurora to Estes Park. How long is that ride?
About 65 miles.
You manage that in a day? One speed bicycle?
That was a 10-speed Schwinn.
10-speed, all right.
Yeah, 10-speed Schwinn with Converse, sneakers, cut-off shorts, a t-shirt, and a pint water bottle.
Oh, boy, lots of water there, huh?
I was so dehydrated when I got up there. My butt was sore. I trained for that for my high school biology teacher. Was a bicycle enthusiast.
Huh.
And so, Mr. Wachholz, and he and his wife were avid bicyclists.
How do you spell his last name?
Oh, boy, I don't know. I'd be guessing. Wachholz or something like that.
That's good enough. Thank you.
So, Tim, the cross-the-street neighbor, who was like 3 years younger than me, and I decided that we were going to ride to Estes Park, and we needed to train. So, three days before the trip was scheduled, his parents decided that he was too young to ride, and so I decided to make the trip myself.
Oh. Well, not only you're fighting the distance, but you're fighting the altitude.
Yeah, but... So, Estes, what's that? It's probably 9,000 feet. Denver's 5,200 feet. So, yeah. About 3,000 foot elevation gain. spent the night with Larry. And the next day, had a wonderful ride downhill to Lyons. And then my high school girlfriend picked me up. And drove home. So I didn't ride. It wasn't a round trip. But then, you know, riding up I forget which river it was.
St. Vrain?
What's that?
The St. Vrain? Or the Poudre?
St. Vrain, the Poudre, Big Thompson Canyon. I can't remember how I went.
Yeah, Big Thompson. Okay.
Frequent stops to get water. And lost himself. Anyway, I rode up, stayed the night with Larry. I might be getting the years convoluted here, but anyway.
So this is 68, and you meet Larry, and he says, "Well, why don't you become an NPS ranger?" And he clearly, liked you enough to invite you up there.
Right. So
whatever summer it was, it would have been the following summer, I think.
'69.
Yeah. I think I got a job in '69 as a recreation technician for the Bureau of Land Management out of Pueblo, Colorado.
Okay.
And on my times off, I'd go back home to Aurora, go up and do some hiking up in Rocky Mountain. And Larry was working at the time as a Long's Peak Ranger.
Ooh, okay.
So I'd go out and patrol with him, and some I did Long's Peak on the east face, several different times on his patrols. But,
did you get into climbing then?
Well, Larry taught me how to climb.
Okay.
I would say that I never got above 5'4" route comfortably.
Okay.
And then, must have been about 1970. Yeah, Larry and I both transferred over to Colorado State University, which at the time was the ranger battle. I was still in forestry, College of Forestry. And, let me think for a minute here. Yeah, so in 77, it must have been 1971.
You know, Kurt, I'm gonna ask you if you wouldn't mind, please, to tell me a little bit about the recreation technician job with the BLM out of Pueblo that summer.
Well,
what kind of stuff? What did they have you doing?
Going to the various campgrounds and cleaning toilets and cleaning campfire pits and talking to people and.
Okay.
Cleaning the fire engine.
Okay.
So it was basically a maintenance job, but they didn't call you maintenance worker.
Okay.
Did that back to school. So I'm just estimating it was someplace around 1971, 72, that Larry and I were rooming together, going to school. It was Easter break, spring break. And he took off and he went to the Grand Canyon. And I took him to Stapleton International Airport in Denver and dropped him off. And when it was time for him to come home, I went back and picked him up and walked him down one of the corridors in Stapleton concourses. And he said, you want a job? I said, sure. He said, you can have a job at Grand Canyon as a backcountry ranger. I said, great.
Wow.
This is April. I said, great. There's only, and this is on a Sunday, there's only one problem. I said, what's that? You have to be there Wednesday.
Ooh. But wait a minute, you're still in school.
Yeah. He had gone to Grand Canyon and visited his former supervisor in the Everglades, Ed Carlson.
How do you spell Ed's last name?
C-A-R-L-S-O-N. And Ed had offered him a job. Larry declined because he wanted to get his college degree. Couldn't drop out of school. He had, six more months or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, okay. Sunday night, I packed up all my stuff. Monday morning, I went in, did the paperwork to drop out of school, drove home to Aurora, and what I called my 1964 Rambler,
actually owned by my father.
Two-door?
No, it's four-door.
Okay.
Reclining seats. Said, I dropped out of college, and parents were like, "You what?" Said, "I got a job working at Grand Canyon National Park." "Well, what are you going to do about college?" I said, "Well, it's for 6 months, and then I'll just go back to school." "Well, okay."
"Yeah.
We don't really approve of this, but drive safely." So I drove down to Grand Canyon and showed up Wednesday morning in Ed Carlson's office. And to show you how things were different then, walked in and said, "Here's your ticket book. Here's your radio. Here's a copy of the Code of Federal Regulations. I want you to read those. Here's your handcuffs. Here's your Smith & Wesson revolver. And we're going to go out to the range this afternoon and I'll teach you how to shoot." I said, "Oh, okay."
Wow.
So we go to his house, have lunch. My wife fixes his lunch. We go out to the range. I qualify the first time. Qualify with a shotgun. He said, "Oh, you're not going to have any problems." He said, "Now, tomorrow, we're going to hook you up with a couple of Wranglers, and they're going to teach you how to pack mules." Well, I had ridden a little bit in high school because my girlfriend had horses. So I was familiar with, you know, trail riding, but I'd never packed. And a couple of old-timer Wranglers that had lived in Arizona all their life and were working for the Park Service as Wranglers.
Do you remember their names?
I don't remember their names.
Okay.
I remember the mule's names.
What were the mule's names?
Well, they gave me Jack and Parrot. And Jack was an old army mule, pulling caissons throughout his army career, so he must have been, you know, I don't know, 18 years old or so. And Parrot was a youngster. She was only about 8, 9 years old. So they taught me how to load panniers and how to secure stuff and a couple of different hitches for 2 days. And then they told me, "Okay, well, you need to go and buy all the stuff you need for the next 10 days because you're going to go to your ranger station tomorrow. And Stan is going to take you." Stan, it'll come to me, I don't remember his last name. He was probably a 35-year-old Arizona cowboy with a big, bushy mustache. And showed up at the barn at 6 o'clock in the morning with all my food. And, you know, the ranger station that I was going to, it had beds, it had sleeping bags, it had a full kitchen, propane-fired stoves, an old diesel engine for electricity. We loaded up, and we rode down the Kaibab Trail, 7 miles to the river, stopped at Phantom Ranch for lunch, maybe an hour. And then we rode 7 miles towards the North Rim, up the North Rim Trail, to a place called Cottonwood. And that's Cottonwood Campground was there, and that was my station. So, moved everything in, got a lay of the land right around the ranger station, which wasn't very far from the White Angel Creek, and went to bed. The next morning, I hear Stan out wrestling around in the kitchen about 5:30 in the morning. I got up and went out and said, "Well, what's going on?" "So I'm heading out. I'm going to get out before it gets hot." "You know, you leaving?"
Yep. I'm 21 years old. I'm in the bottom of the Grand Canyon with Ted and Parrot at 8 o'clock in the morning. Dan's long gone back down the trail to go to the South Rim. And that was the beginning of my Park Service career.
So Stan split out with the mules, and there you were.
Well, I kept Ted and Parrot. They stayed with me. He took the other mule that he had with him.
Oh, he took Jack?
No, Jack was my riding mule, and Jack? Parrot was my...
Okay.
So Jack and Parrot stayed with me.
All right.
And Stan took a couple of the other mules and left.
Okay.
So I don't know what all he had packed in, the supplies for the station and supplies for the diesel generator and whatnot.
Did he kind of orient you on the way in that, you know, Roaring Springs is up the way and you know, this is Phantom Ranch, here are some of the people here, and or did he just take you on in and that was that?
No, he gave me a little orientation.
Okay.
And reiterated, the mules will take care of you.
Hmm.
When you're coming out, they know where to stop. They know how long to stop. You just ride them. So, of course, I thought that was silly, but learned later on that that was very correct.
Mm.
So, yeah, Jack and Parrot and I had a great time. And this was April, so there weren't a whole lot of hikers coming through. So my job was to patrol the area. Keep the campground clean, keep the diesel generator serviced, and, you know, go up to Roaring Springs, and there was an operator there that ran that that intake system.
Who was the operator at Roaring Springs at the time?
You know, I'm not sure exactly who it was in 1972, but I'm pretty sure that it was Bruce Aiken.
Okay.
That name sounds familiar.
Absolutely. So Bruce and his wife Mary.
Right.
And they would have been young like you.
Yep. And I'm pretty sure it was Bruce, because now that I think about it, it had to be, because I was only at Cottonwood for that one spring, summer, fall.
And that's spelled A-I-K-E-N, is that right?
Yeah, I think that's right. Wonderful person. Incredible artist.
Hmm. Was he doing his artwork back then in 1972 when you went up and knocked on the door?
Yes.
Nice.
And, yeah. So
I'm. Can I ask you some questions about Cottonwood? It's a small little ranger station. There's not. It's a. Gosh, can you describe that building? It's not that big.
My recollection is, you walked in the front door. You walked into the kitchen living room, which is, I don't know, 14 by 14, that's just a guess. And my recollection is, off of each side were two bedrooms, which each had two cots, two bunks. Well, they weren't bunk beds. Two beds. They were metal frame, metal springs, and an old-time striped mattress in each one, and all of the legs had tin cans. The legs were stuck into tin cans, and the tin cans were kept full of, well, it had about half an inch of oil in them, so that if a scorpion climbed up the tin can to get to the leg, he would have to go down into the can and get stuck in the oil.
That was your scorpion prevention system.
Yep.
Yeah. Any rattlesnakes?
Did you have a radio?
Yeah, I had a radio, and I had a phone. I had a phone that connected to Park Dispatch.
Okay.
So, if I needed anything, all I had to do was pick up the phone, or I could call dispatch on the radio.
And this is April 1972, was there anybody camping in the campground then? Or were the hikers just heading on through to Phantom? Or were they stopping at Cottonwood on a multi-day crossing?
Yeah, they were stopping. There were very few people doing cross canyon hikes in a day.
Okay.
So, you left the North Rim, you came to Cottonwood and stayed, then you went to Phantom, then you went out. Or
over to Indian Gardens and...
Yeah, Indian Gardens, Phantom, Cottonwood.
Yeah.
The North Rim. I just got to explore the area.
That's some neat area to explore there.
Yeah. Do you know about Rainbow Falls?
No.
Oh. About a mile down towards Phantom, mile and a half, there's a place called Rainbow Falls. And it's a travertine waterfall that's about, my recollection is, it's about 60 feet tall.
So I'm thinking about Ribbon Falls.
Wiggins?
Ribbon, R-I-B-B-O-N, I think. Ribbon.
Oh, okay. Yeah, you're right. Ribbon Falls.
Okay, but I was thinking, wait a minute, maybe it's got another name and it's called Rainbow Falls.
Yeah, well, in my brain it's called Rainbow Falls.
That's a nice name for it.
So, there's also, at the time, nobody knew about it, but I think it's been discovered, there's Upper Ribbon Falls.
Yes.
And, so I would patrol up there, and of course there wouldn't be anybody there.
Hmm.
And, here's an interesting tidbit. On one day, on one patrol, I was halfway up towards Upper Ribbon Falls and looked over to my right, and there's some, I recollect it was probably sandstone, might have been a different formation. But they had little crevices that were about a foot deep. So I don't know why, but I decided that I'd pull out film canister, back in the days when we used film, and I put my name and address and phone number in it and stuck it in one of those crevices, thinking that someday somebody would find it and they could call me. Well, of course, I no longer live there and my phone number is defunct, but just sort of the weird things you do when you're out there doing stuff. Another incident at Ribbon Falls, after a heavy rainstorm, some hikers came up to the ranger station and were very excited. They said, "We just found a pot. There's a pot stuck in the edge of a wall, and half of it's been exposed because of the rains."
Wow.
So I got on the phone and I called the park archaeologist. Bob, somebody.
Euler?
Bob Euler.
E-U-H-L-E-R?
As far as I know, yeah.
Okay.
I'm just a nice, nice man. So I called Bob. How I had known him already, I don't really know. But I knew to call Bob. So I get Bob on the phone. And now I'm all excited. this is an ancient Indian pot.
Mm.
What do you want me to do? He said, "Well, just take a spoon and go down and very carefully excavate it out of the wall, and I'll send a helicopter in tomorrow, and we'll pick it up." And I thought, not only did I just get dropped off a couple weeks ago, now I'm supposed to go excavate this ancient pot. These things are rare. They're valuable. They're treasures. Yeah, just go excavate it out of the wall.
With a spoon.
Yeah, with a spoon. So I go down there, and the guy, the visitor, show me where it is, and I'm like, it's not half exposed. It's like a third exposed. I hope I don't break this thing. So I get it out, and I very gingerly carry it back up to the station. I don't put it in my backpack. I carry it. And I call Bob and say, okay, I got it. I said, okay, well, we'll send the helicopter in tomorrow. You know, put it on the shelf. So it's sitting on the kitchen table while I'm having dinner. And I'm going, oh, man, this thing is amazing. And they come in, they get the pot, they fly away. And when I come out after my 10-day tour, of course, I want to go to the museum and see the pot. So I go to the park museum, and I don't know if it was Bob or one of his assistants. They said, well, it's right back here. So we go in the storage area, and there's like 40 or 50 pots that look exactly like mine.
Wow.
And eventually, that pot was moved. What's the name down in Tucson, the Southern Arizona Archaeological Society.
The Western Area Conservation, the WAC folks down there? Or?
Yeah, the WAC. It was moved down there. Well, come to find out, I never went down there, that I recall. They have so many pots from that era and lack of storage space that I was told that many of the pots that are not in the best of shape are cut in half and nestled into each other.
Hmm.
Because there's so many of them. So, from my one-of-a-kind, unique, rare, find at Ribbon Falls, I began to understand that there are a lot of artifacts.
Yeah. Was this painted, or was it thumbnail, that kind of pushed thumbnail wear? Or was it smooth on the outside, just a regular smooth sort of, you know, fire cloud kind of burn?
It was smooth. It was red in color. And I do not recall any decorations on it.
Okay. Wow. Huh. So that's your first 10-day tour. Wow.
Well, that pot and the sticking my name in the Kodak with the film canister I wouldn't say those occurred on the first 10-day tour. Those occurred during the summer.
That summer, okay. And you
6 month period.
You met the Aikens and
period. Bob Cornelius, who you've spoken with, was the Phantom Ranch Ranger.
Okay.
And occasionally, we had opposite days off. So his 4 days off were different than mine, and I would pack enough stuff in or get resupplied by helicopter. That after my 10-day tour at Cottonwood, I'd go down to Phantom Ranch for 4 days. And then the day he was coming back in, I'd ride back up to Cottonwood. So either 24 days was the longest time I ever spent. Consecutively.
Nice.
on that range of patrol type stuff.
Nice.
You know, another person that I think he may have passed already, that you might find interesting in interviewing, was a fellow by the name of Ed Starkey.
Yes.
Stark, what was his last name?
S-T-A-R-K-E-K-Y-E or K-E-Y?
I think it's K-E-Y. He worked for the United States Geological Survey. And he, my recollection is, he lived in the Pink House close to Phantom Ranch, but it's a USGS housing. And he ran the gauging stations down on the river.
What do you remember about him?
I remember that he never left the Grand Canyon, except he had to leave once a year for his evaluation. And he told me that when he had to go out, he started getting so nervous that he got hives.
Really?
But for some reason, it was always nice to me. And one of the things I remember about Ed is, see, this won't affect my retirement. No, I think I can tell the story. I'm riding through, go down to Phantom Ranch, take a break. And then it's, half a mile or so up to Phantom Ranch from the river.
Uh-huh.
And I'm riding by on a hot summer day. And Ed comes out and hands me, says, "Hey, got something for you for your trip up to Cottonwood." "What is it?" "It's lemonade. Ice cold lemonade." "So, well, thanks. That's, you know, in a container like today's Sloopy cup or something."
Big.
And it had a lid on it. "You can just take that. That'll keep you cool." "Well, thanks." Ed never got off the wheel. Just passing by. He said, "Yep, have a good trip." Stan Stockton, that's the cowboy. We'll come back to Stan in a minute. So I get past Phantom Ranch, and I'm getting a little thirsty, and I said, "Well, I think I'll have a drink of this lemonade." Well, Ed forgot to tell me that he put some bourbon in the lemonade. I think he put about half of it bourbon in the lemonade. I was young then, so it was probably only a couple shots. But so I'm proceeding to ride up with my mules to Cottonwood, sipping on lemonade, nobody on the trail, just riding along having lemonade, and that's what I remember about Ed Starkey.
Hmm. Did you ever get a chance to ride out on the cable with him and watch him do his USGS sampling?
No, I never. Actually, yeah, I did go out on the cable with him once.
What was that like?
Well, it felt safe. It's kind of strange being suspended over the Colorado River.
Hmm.
I don't know how high we were above it, 40 feet, 50 feet.
Uh-huh.
And you're just sort of swaying, and, you know, to Ed, it's like Roy Starkey was his name.
Yes.
And, you know, he's in this small little contraption of a basket, and it was just like watching him conduct a symphony or something. I don't know how I want to describe it. He didn't move much. He had everything positioned, cranked up some buckets, some samples, took them, and pulled his back in, tied off, and out we got. And, you know, he did it, I don't know how often he did it, but he'd obviously been doing it for years and years. And, yeah, so a bit of a recluse.
Was he tall? Was he short? How would you describe him?
Well, I'm 5'10". I'd say, I don't know, he was 5'8", 5'7".
Okay.
Light blonde hair. Thin. Fit. You know, the How would I describe Roy Starkey? Wiry.
Okay.
Wiry. Hmm. Yeah. Had a very funny laugh. Almost like a giggle.
Huh.
And he liked to laugh, so.
Did you guys talk politics or park management? Did you talk state of the world or canyon adventures?
With Roy?
Yeah.
Well, my recollection is just conversation in passing about what was going on. But the dudes looked like at Phantom Ranch the night before.
Okay.
How drunk the trail crew got at the trail crew bunkhouse the night before. I don't bet you Roy was back there with him.
I was wondering.
Yeah, if you talk to talk to Bob Cornelius again, you might ask him, or maybe you already have, or have listened to all of them, if he talked about Roy. So.
Yeah, I'm always just asking everybody the same questions. So that's all right. And of course, Roy's got a beach named after him. A little, not much left of it now, because the sand's lots gone, but Roy's Beach there. Upstream of the cableway.
Hmm.
It's, you know, it's a, I don't think it's official USGS name. Huh.
Yeah, so then another recollection is I was at Phantom Ranch covering one time, and I don't recall who they were, but, you know, this is my first year with Park Service, and I'm, what, 21, 22. And I'm informed that the director of the Park Service, I wonder who that was in 1972. Was that Dickinson?
I'd have to look it up.
Anyway, the director of the Park Service, maybe it was just the regional director, but a director, I think it was the Park Service, could have been the regional director, was going to be arriving at Phantom Ranch and staying overnight at the bunkhouse. Okay. So what do you want me to do? Well, go down and greet the boat, show them around.
Oh, they were coming in by boat.
Yeah, they were on a river trip.
Okay.
So, I spend a good bit of time not far from the river to make sure I don't miss them, because I'm supposed to greet them. And in comes, I don't know, one, two boats. I think there were motor rigs. I know there were motor rigs. That's what the Park Service ran in 72.
Uh-huh.
J-rigs. And so the person running that boat was probably Tom Doerr. D-O-E-R-R. So they pull in, and, you know, I'm like in awe. The director is here. And so I, quote, show them around. And then there's Phantom Ranch up there, and there's the bunkhouse. And see ya. Well, it's dinner time, and there's a knock on the ranger station door. I open the door, and it's the director. And he said, you know, we're having dinner over here. Why don't you come on over and have dinner with us? I thought, well, how unusual is this? So that was my first exposure to, one of my first exposures, to the Park Service family.
Hmm, okay.
You know, just regular old folks worked their way up through the Park Service just like everybody else had. And they didn't forget that they were rangers at one time.
Nice.
That was pretty impressive. to a 22-year-old. You don't forget where you came from. So I went over and had dinner. Didn't say a word.
Oh.
So, but they were all very cordial, and I left the next morning. Yeah, this is good. I haven't thought about this stuff for a long time. Well, I want to go back to Stan Stockton, the cowboy that rode me down, or, you know, guided me down, gave me the advice. He and I became pretty good friends. I think Stan was in charge of what would have been called the trail crew then, because he showed up at Cottonwood with his trail crew cronies several different times, and they would stay for 5-6 days at a time. But just an Arizona cowboy. Salt of the earth. I don't know if he's still around, but I might want to try and run him down.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have any contact info for him.
Okay.
The one story I'll tell you is I was over at his house one time, and we're talking, and he said, "So, I got something I want to show you." And he pulls this box out from under a table, and he opens it up, and he pulls out the top, well, it wouldn't be the top, middle part of an agave stem with the spine sticking out.
Uh-huh.
And there's a swift impaled on that spine.
Wow.
With its wings open.
Wow.
And this had been flying through the air, and for whatever reason, either chasing something or avoiding something, it flew directly into the spine, killed itself, and it mummified in place like that with the colors still intact.
Wow.
And Stan was riding between Phantom Ranch and Cottonwood one time, and he just happened to look over and see it. So he collected it.
And that's hard to do on a mule, to get it out of the canyon without hurting it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so and that's what I remember about Stan.
Hmm. Wow. Huh. What did you do with your trash back then in 1972 at Cottonwood?
You packed it out.
Okay.
I think I had a trash compactor. But, you know, your panniers were basically empty when you were heading out, so you packed out whatever trash you needed to go out.
Mm-hmm.
Trash that other people left, that packed out. Your own trash.
Bob was talking about burning trash down at Phantom, and I know eventually that changed, but and this was, I'm trying to remember when the permitting system came in, whether it was, would have been right about that time. And Cornelius had been to Phantom for a couple of years before you arrived. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. Was Cottonwood busy? Were there a lot of people there at times?
No.
Okay.
No, there might have been, I don't know, 10, 15 people there at a time. My recollection. There weren't that many people coming through Cottonwood.
Okay.
I imagine there are now.
Yeah, it's different. That summer of 72, were you talking to Larry or writing him at all every now and then about how your summer was going?
No.
Okay. Were you communicating with your folks back home?
Oh yeah, I was communicating with them. Probably talking to them on the phone.
Okay.
Yeah. think when Mom came down to visit, that would have been 74 or 75.
Okay.
Yeah, and we'll get there.
The other thing I was thinking was you'd been to Newfoundland, you'd spent a lot of time in the Yukon. Madrid might be the closest thing you'd come to that kind of heat. How did you manage that first summer?
Well, I was 22.
Okay. And you had some nice lemonade.
Yeah, and I had some nice lemonade. You just got stuff done in the early morning hours.
Okay.
And then, when you got to Ribbon Falls, you spent an excessive amount of time there.
Okay. Cool. Yeah.
You didn't go out on patrols in the afternoon. Everything done.
And then, I'm sorry?
It was warm.
And then finally, of course, the monsoons, the summer rains would have come in.
Yep, incredible waterfalls. Incredible waterfalls.
And this was all after the 1960s pipeline major flash flood.
Oh, yeah. Daddy Pat. Yeah, so 1972, I remember they were working on the pipeline. 1972, I'm getting things mixed up, but at any rate, I was in a Bell helicopter with a pilot. We were sling loading something down to Phantom Ranch. And the way they were sling loading it was on a tilt trailer. The helicopter was sitting beside it. And the pilot took off, went to full power. And when he told them to, they tilted that tilt trailer, and whatever he was carrying slid off the edge of the rim.
Wow.
At full power, and we dropped probably 500 feet. And then he was able to get enough power to fly it down to Phantom. Now, can you imagine doing that today?
I can't imagine doing that at all.
Them on a tilt trailer, and you have a passenger?
Yeah. Holy cow. No wonder it took you 500 feet to try to get some airspeed.
And that's the other interesting thing about flying out of the canyon, which I did a lot of in later years because I was in search and rescue. Helicopters were phenomenal. We'll get into talking about some of the pilots that I flew with. They were all phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
But you fly, have you flown in a helicopter in the canyon?
No, I have not.
You start flying towards the rim, you're going up, and then you're getting closer and closer to the rim, and you're thinking, we're going to fly directly into this rock wall, which is like, I don't know what the top strata.
Kaibab?
But you fly towards the wall, and then the air currents pick that helicopter up. And if you ever stand on the rim and you watch the ravens,
yes,
you can see that effect. Because they just fly towards the rim. They're like 1,000 feet below the rim of the canyon, and they don't flap once. They just catch the currents and soar right up above the rim. Soar 500 to 1,000 feet above the rim. And then I've watched them play with each other and do acrobatics, flipping over on their back, doing somersaults.
Yeah.
So all those air currents work for the birds, they work for the helicopter too.
Nice. Stan, I've got to tell you, we've been yik-yakking about an hour and a half.
Yes, sir.
And I think this might be a good place to wrap up part one.
Okay.
And we will pick this thread up. So I'm going to wrap up this interview then. This is the end of part one, oral history interview with Kurt Sauer. Today is September 4th, 2020. My name is Tom Martin. And Kurt, hold the line for a second, and thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.